Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has 15 years of law enforcement analysis experience, with experience at both Mansfield, Ohio PD and Cary, North Carolina PD. She's a certified crime and intelligence analyst from California State University, here to talk to us about cost-effective software. Please welcome Beverly Lewis. Beverly, how are we doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I am well. It's good to hear you. It's been a while since we chatted.
Yes.
All right. So let's get into it. How did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
Well, I think crime analysis found me. I began my career in law enforcement in Mansfield, Ohio, as you said, when I became a clerk typist, which is like a secretary in the traffic unit. And that was in 1998. I spent several years in that unit before I became a grants manager and a special projects coordinator in the office of the chief. So in that position, I had assisted with the accreditation as we were just getting ready to do our on-site when the accreditation manager was called into active duty. So it was there that I was actually introduced to crime analysis. There were certain documents required to meet an accreditation standard that required statistics, as I recall, and I was tasked to complete them. You can understand how that works. So I had a chief that was very forward-thinking, and he wanted me to get trained as a crime analyst. You know, keep in mind that we were a medium-sized department with about 80 sworn and about 50,000 in population. So we were small to medium size, and no other departments in Ohio that small had a crime analyst. So it took me about a year, but I became a certified crime and intelligence analyst. And in doing so, I became the first crime analyst in the Mansfield Division of Police.
So did they require you to be certified before you got the position?
No. I came in doing what was termed the work of a crime analyst at that time. So I had already started working as an analyst, but that wasn't my primary duty. So as I found this training, I reached out to my chief and I said, these are several classes that I could take to become certified. And that certification actually proved very powerful for me because not only did it give me credentials in order to be recognized as a crime analyst, the city of Mansfield had at times went through difficult financial times where everyone that was not full-time, I was part-time at the time, were being laid off. But because I had that certification, it saved my job. So I worked in Mansfield for quite a few years and really was able to build up the one-person unit that I was and was able to get that buy-in from sworn because that was such a new concept to have a civilian analyst to direct their efforts. And I did get some pushback because you have old school officers who didn't want a civilian telling them how to do their job. But as I got more established, I was able to really influence some of our highest crime areas, including what I did as a weekly report on our residential burglaries. So I put that weekly report out every week, whether anyone read it or not. So that became part of my focus. And that was my focus all the way up to the time that I left.
And were you able to put in information in there that the beat cop wouldn't know, hence made it a little bit more valuable?
Yes, I was able to put in, of course, the mapping and the time of day, day of week kind of analysis. At that time, we were averaging about 20 to 25 residential burglaries a week. And that's for a town that's 50,000 people. So I was able to put that information out. And as I gleaned through and found suspect information or information where maybe an offender was escalating that had a burglary history, I was able to put their information on that report as well. And there were times when I was dead on, but not necessarily still because it was so new, the buy-in wasn't totally there. It was more came to be almost like reactive, you know, wait, hey, you know, what you said was true kind of thing. So that was a challenge, but my chief stood behind me 100%. He made sure that what he called branding. So my name and my title had to go on every single report that I put out. So he was very good at that support, and he's the one that pushed it from the top down. So I had that awesome support, and he's the one that allowed me to do as much training as I wanted. When I left the Mansfield PD, I was still part-time. I was doing that time 32 hours, but I was doing so much in those 32 hours. So that's one of the reasons that I felt that I was getting to be a big fish in a small pond. I really wanted to expand on what I was able to do. And that was left to that difficult decision of leaving Mansfield for a position in North Carolina.
Yeah. Are you originally from Ohio?
Yes. Born and raised in Mansfield.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So this is leaving home. I get you. So before we get to your transition to Cary, I'm curious to know, you talked about grant writing. Did you bring any kind of special grants to Mansfield as a crime analyst?
No, I wasn't a grant writer. I was a grant manager, which any grants that we had received in Mansfield, I did all the financial managing of it, as far as even reporting each quarter on our expenditures, that kind of thing. So when I came into that position, we had, I think, three or four grants going at the same time. And so I had to manage all those, make sure that everything had asset tags and that it was spent out at the end of most of them were 3 years. We did the JAG grant quite a bit and some of the other grants that were available. Primarily, my position was funded in those grants, the crime analyst position.
That can be tough because grants are termed in that they're very specific times. And so sometimes you don't know when a grant is going to be renewed.
So that is absolutely true. And I was under grant for 10 years. So my chief made sure that was part of what the expenditures were in some of those grants. And the best part of that was that also paid for a lot of my training. Mm-hmm. So I was able to continue to grow as an analyst and make that a viable part of the department so that even after I left, they hired another analyst. So they found value in that. And my chief had always said, you know, if you got to cut anything, don't cut crime analysis and don't cut any of the youth programming. Mm-hmm. So he knew that those were two valuable components that were not only valuable to our police officers, but they were extremely valuable to our citizens. That was really who we really worked for.
Was there a training or two that you found to be particularly useful?
I think when I took that first crime analysis class, that was through the Alpha Group Center, which was recognized by the Sacramento University. So that really whet my appetite for crime analysis. And I would keep my little workbook and my book that I got from that class. And throughout the years, I have referred back to that. I had a lot of statistical type measures and how to set up things and how to word things. And that was, you know, being new into the field, you need those things.
Steve Gottlieb's going to be proud of that statement.
Yes, yes. I referred to him several times in everything that I've done. So that kind of whet my appetite for it. And then I continued, my really desire to grow this field made me continue to reach out to even what we might call more obscure training. I did crime prevention training. I did even just Excel for law enforcement kind of training. So anything that I could take a class in, even if it was like a regular law enforcement class where it's like a week long or whatever, and bring something back from that class to use in my job. That was the most valuable training that I ever got. It was not obscure knowledge. It was like, hey, I can use this today. So, and that's always how I've approached training is if I can use it today, I will put my heart into it.
Nice. As you look back at your time there in Mansfield, is there a particular project or case that you're proud of?
Yes and no, I guess, because when you are an analyst and you're right about a prediction, you feel like that's a win because you were right. Mm-hmm. But if there was another victim, that's not a win. And I had that discussion throughout the years is if I predict something and it's right, is that good or bad? So the one that that pops into my mind, and this is almost a bad example, is that on my burglary report, I was able to identify an offender that was more a thorn in the side. He was continually breaking into places, stealing things, of course, and some of them that he was just doing is squatting. So he showed up on our radar as someone that needed to be talked to. And when I did that, put that out on the bulletin, that was like thinking at the end of January. 2 weeks later, this offender breaks into someone's home and murders them.
Oh.
To me, that's a horrible example, but it also shows the power of crime analysis if it's put in place, if it's used, because they could have actually interrupted this offender's activity if they had used the crime analysis to go and do like a knock and talk type thing. They may have prevented this. Now, would they have 100%? I honestly couldn't tell you. But that to me was a bad example of not using crime analysis.
Yeah, when you first said that, I was just like, well, as long as no one got hurt physically, that's what was my first thought when you said that. Had the burglar been violent prior to that? Or is it a situation where the homeowner woke up and interrupted the burglary?
No, he had not been violent prior to that, but the situation escalated because he took his girlfriend along with him to break into this person's house. The homeowner was actually drunk, coming on to the girlfriend who supposedly went in to use the phone kind of thing. And they had broken into that house prior. I don't know how long before that, maybe a month or so. So he knew what he had in there. But when the homeowner came on to the girlfriend and she didn't resist because she saw that he had a gun, that made the boyfriend angry and he went in and that's where it got bad. So, and after they murdered the guy, they still stole his 70-inch TV.
Yeah, that's what it was over, a 70-inch TV. So did they have a weapon or did they use his weapon?
They used a weapon out of the kitchen.
Okay. So even though he had a gun, they were able to, take a knife or something?
Yeah. Yeah. He was drunk, very drunk. So.
Yeah, that's a bad one there. I'm sorry to hear that.
But, you know, I mean, I think that just speaks volumes to the fact that, yes, we are civilians. Yes, we're not on the street and we're not dealing with this every day. That what we bring to the table is valuable and should be considered, because I think we, as analysts, we get a bigger picture. We got all the data. We have the mapping. We have, you know, the suspect information, the history. We have all those tools at our disposal that an officer may not. So really putting that into as part of either their roll call or just something that they keep in abreast them of, I think is very valuable. And as I know, that was a horrible example, and I'm sorry that happened. I really am. But I think it speaks to the fact that crime analysis needs to be taken seriously, and it needs to be part of the department.
Agreed. Well, now let's move on to Carrie then. Mm-hmm. So you make the big leap from your hometown of Mansfield to Cary, North Carolina. And is this a full-time position now?
Yes, this is full time.
Right. All right, excellent. Let's talk about that transition then. And looking back at it now, what were things going through your head? How do you think you went from being an analyst at Mansfield to analyst at Cary?
Well, like I said, I started feeling more like I was a big fish in a little pond because my only assignment was not crime analysis. I was also a coordinator for a children's program. I did the annual report. You know, I wore several hats. And so this opportunity to really focus on crime analysis was, I think, where my heart was and where I needed to be. So I had put out several applications and out of state because there was no positions in Ohio available at that time. So I knew that I had to go out of state. So I had tried several different places, including Memphis, Tennessee, and Fayetteville, North Carolina, and actually even a fire analyst for Cary at one time. But when I finally made it to Cary and I was granted to interview, I had interviewing experience by that point because I had tried several options. So I really just really focused on giving it my all for that interview. I did everything that I could think of. I created them a bulletin. I did their statistics. I brought all my training records and everything else that I could think of to this interview. And it was like, this is now or never, because I'm running out of money going to interviews. So when I became part of the Cary Police Department, it was a place where even following the interview, when you get to chatting with other people in a department, it was, this is a great place to work. And when I finally did get hired, I could see that the environment, the support for crime analysis came from the chief's office. There was another analyst, so I actually had a partner for a while, which I never had before. And that was really what I wanted, because I wanted to be able to grow as an analyst and I'd be able to have someone that I could bounce ideas off of and work with. So having a partner was very important to me and one of the reasons why I left Mansfield. So I came into the Cary Police Department, and one of the things that I saw immediately was that they were very focused on stats and maps, which was really not my forte. I didn't want to just print maps every. We were at the point where every first of the month, we were doing 20 plus reports with five plotter size maps for each of the districts. And that was my whole day, day and a half almost, of getting those reports out every month. My first thought was, I don't like this part of this. I want to do more. So in time, I was able to automate a lot of those reports, find out what people were using and not using, which is always a good thing every once in a while to go through and, hey, are you really still using this? And a lot of times you'll find they're not. It was just become part of the routine and was able to eliminate some of the things that they weren't doing and to really start focusing on being more of a crime analyst and not a stats and maps person. So in doing that, I was able to develop some access databases, which was my primary tool for a long time, because I was able to start now tracking crime trends and offenders and really putting out something that was more valuable to our department, our officers.
Now, do you have a records management system at this time?
Yes.
So you're doing ODBC connection into Access?
Yes.
All right. Sorry, tech talk there for real quick. Go ahead.
Yes. That was the only way you could get into Access at that time. Yeah. And we had OSSI, RMS, and CAD. So it wasn't too bad to connect into that. That's the same system that we're using in Ohio, which made it a little easier for the transition. So yes, I could bring all that information, all those tables into Access and be able to leverage the data in there.
So when you're from Mansfield and you've worked at other places in Mansfield, you obviously know the ins and outs of Mansfield. You're coming over now to Cary, which you were not familiar with Cary prior to applying for the job, right?
No,
I was not. So how did you go about getting to know the city of Cary?
I think that goes back to my department. They made sure, first of all, that I had a ride along in every one of our districts. I sat in on meetings with our specialty teams, as well as our criminal intelligence unit and our detectives. I was a part of all those meetings, as well as being able to just really get to know. I think part of it was the communication with the other analyst and with the department. Like I said, they made sure I went on ride-alongs and they made sure that I was involved in those meetings. So you become familiar very quickly with the demographics of Cary and how things flow. If you're not familiar with Cary right now, Cary, I think, is 165,000 people. It might be a little bit more now since the census came out.
Sure.
And it is a almost like a suburb of Raleigh, although it's pretty good size. And it was more of a higher income area. So each area of Cary, each of the districts really had their own little personality. We had a western part of Cary that was more of the affluent area where there wasn't the retail aspect of it with the burglaries and the robberies and that kind of thing. It was more calls for service natures where if my koi fish was stolen out of my pond, I want the police to recover it. And one of the things that I did, I'm sorry, I meant to say, is that my department had me go through their Citizens Police Academy. That program allowed me to get to know each part of the department and how it operated and some of the people that worked in those departments that I might not see every day. So the ride-alongs, the meetings, and the Citizens Police Academy really helped me to get to know the area.
And so what crime problems are you dealing with when you first get to Cary?
Cary's primary crime, highest crime type, was actually larceny from motor vehicle. A lot of areas may be familiar with the fact that many people feel that they don't have to lock their cars because the police are going to protect them.
That always surprises me. It surprises me that we're still dealing with this 20, 30 years now, right? I mean, it's so funny. Every time I go to a park and I see put your junk in the trunk or something clever there about locking up your valuables, it seems to me that should be a no-brainer. That should be something that we don't need to tell people, but obviously we do.
Absolutely. That was, and we, you know, we went in line with that. We also dealt with the Felony Lane Gang, if you're familiar with that.
No, I'm not.
Felony Lane Gang is actually a national trend where a group will come, usually from out of state, and break into cars and steal like a woman's purse or wallet. And when it started out, it was more, you know, we didn't use credit cards or debit cards so much. So it was the checkbook. And they would write a check and take it to the bank and cash it before the person even knew that their wallet was stolen. Mm-hmm. They would use the last lane of the bank in the drive-through. Usually, if it was a woman that they stole from, they would put a wig on that looked similar to the picture on their driver's license.
That's clever.
So, yes. And then later, you know, as they morphed and things, they started using more of the debit cards and the credit cards. But they were physically breaking into cars at that time. They would usually break a window. But it was a group that would come through and they would hit and then they were gone. And then if it was, it's not just one group, it may be somebody else that totally unrelated will come through and do the same thing. It's a Google offense because you can look it up and learn how to do it. So, yes, for Cary, that was our primary crime type. But as time has progressed, you know, and in all of national crime trends, violence has become more pronounced. And that was even in Cary. Now, we didn't have the murder rate as other cities our size, but we were increasingly seeing more violent crimes. So that became, larceny of motor vehicles is always going to be there. That's always going to be a part of people not leaving their cars unlocked, leaving their valuables in sight. That's always going to be a part of law enforcement in general. But that progression really required analysts to be a step up a little bit and really start looking at offenders and looking at time of day and day of week and that kind of thing and start putting that information out on a more regular basis.
So this brings us to your badge story, and the analyst badge story for those that may be new to the show is the career defining case or project that an analyst works on. And for you, Beverly, yours is here in Cary PD dealing with the patrol schedule.
Yes. So a totally different take on crime analysis where, you know, you're used to more looking at crimes and trying to put something out. This was actually began back in 2019 early for us. We began working on it in April. It had started with the department before that. They were looking to be able to update the patrol schedule to be more efficient using data-driven solutions. So originally, they had contacted consultants in order to create this report. But then they realized that they had the talent and the resources in-house. And that was my crime analysis partner, Melanie Hole, and I that were tasked with this gigantic project. So we were told that what we needed to be able to do was duplicate the consultant's product and make it better. So, you know, you think that's, you know, like way over in other duties as assigned, but it was something that we believed in very strongly because up to this point, the patrol schedule hadn't been changed since 1989. The only change that was made was they began about 5 years ago or so of rotating that same schedule. So officers, every 28 days, they would go from days to afternoons to nights, and back to afternoons and to days. So their schedule was constantly changing. And we could see how that was wearing on the department and how it was wearing on our officers, because you can't be 100% when you're not getting the proper rest and your family life balance is off because of that. And our department recognized that. So we were very invested in really seeing that change. But for my partner and I both, this was a steep learning curve. So we had to get our IT staff involved to make more secure connections outside of RMS and CAD so that we could use it in a product that was fairly new to law enforcement at that time, was Power BI. So we had to get that set up. They had to set up the Power BI service so that we could share that information throughout the department. And on top of that, we had to learn how to use Power BI to really leverage the data in order to get comprehensive visuals that we could deep dive into our own data.
Then did you purchase Power BI, or was that something that the city had purchased?
Yes, the town had purchased it, but at that time, they had very, very little users. This product was, if you even look it up now, is relatively cheap. I think at the time that they originally purchased, they got like $6.95 a month or something like that for each license. So they had already purchased it. But when they started seeing the value of it, then we got a more of a townwide license. Mm-hmm. So it really was very new starting out when we started using it in the department. And nobody really had any training. We went to a one-day training in Charlotte on Dashboard in a Day, is what it was called, through Microsoft, in order to learn this product that we were going to do this comprehensive study on. It took a lot of effort on our part to really learn how to leverage this program. When we started getting more and more into it, we had a team that we could bounce ideas off of, which is awesome. It's set up with IT and the fire department. And us work together on really understanding this product and working through some of the pain points. But when we did that, we learned how to use that and was able to duplicate all the visuals that were used in the consultant's product, the charts and things that they used, we were able to duplicate using our data. And the other thing that was part of this whole process was really getting to know how calls for service affected our officers, our sworn personnel, and got a fuller understanding of their day-to-day activities. That was very important part of this, that we were just not looking at data, that we had really some personal experience that we could incorporate into the findings that we found.
What's some examples of that?
On the report itself, we had to not only look at certain crime types, but also the response time, how many calls there were, how long it took on each call, how many officers were involved in each call. So we were able to pull that information together, and each one of those components was actually a separate deep dive study. This is what our findings were. It took this many officers to respond to this many call types. This is our highest call type. You know, this is how long it took. And we also incorporated, of course, like a lot of agencies, response time. We took all that into consideration when we did this product. And one of the things that we included in our report that was not in the consultant's product was any proactive measures that our department was already doing. So that was part of the whole bigger picture. So one of our command staff described this as like building an airplane while it was in flight.
Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Leanne Perry. I have a public service announcement. Don't get so set in your way of thinking that you don't allow yourself the flexibility to grow in your thoughts. Be willing to consider other people's viewpoints and critically think through them. Changing your mind is not the end of the world. Keep your mind open enough so that it's at least a possibility.
This is Emmanuel James Tang, and I invite you to visit leapodcasts.com on the second and fourth Thursday of the month. Starting from 12th November, I've joined with ACIA and LEA Podcasts to present our Africa series of podcasts. We aim to bridge understanding between Africa and the rest of the analytical world. With shared thought and a common lexicon, we aim to broaden our analysts' worldviews, mitigate cognitive bias, refine analytical tradecraft, and improve investigative outcomes everywhere. Analysis improves through exchange.
So for those that aren't familiar with Power BI, can you just give a general description and maybe how does it compare or differ to maybe something that folks might be familiar with, like Access or Excel?
Well, if you think about any time that you've ever made a chart in Excel, those visuals have underlying data. And within Power BI, you can do those straightforward chart type things, but you can do a lot of measures and what they call in Power BI DAX measures, which is more of the algorithm, if per se, of how we can look at data. With Power BI, you can set up filters and time ranges and that kind of thing that will completely change every visual based on the filter that you do. So that in that way, if we had a basic visual like you do in Excel, there was this many calls for service for these years, for example. In Power BI, you can drill down into that. You can see how many were in each month, or you can see how many were in each day, and you can see where they were and you know the time of day that it occurred. And so it's more intuitive to really deep dive. If you've ever seen anything that was like a dashboard, maybe even in your doctor's office or whatever, how those little line charts and pie charts and everything change based on your data, that's kind of the intuitive way that Power BI works. So this enabled the report not to be static, not just something you print off and put in a binder. This was, hey, if I do this, how will this affect that? Or can I look at the last 6 months versus the previous 6 months? Or anything like that can be able to be done in Power BI. It's extremely powerful. And we were able to connect our RMS and CAD data into it. So every table in behind RMS and CAD could be leveraged. And that's another difference in even doing it in Excel or something of that nature, that you can bring all this layers of data into this analysis. So that was one component of being able to really get the bigger picture of what the activity was for our patrols.
What did you find? How did the department come to the conclusion on what the patrol schedule should be?
Well, they took all those components as well as some of the major charts within that report, which was able to indicate how many calls for service that we had in each beat and district, as well as per hour, that kind of thing. So they were taking some of those components of that chart. Like I said, it made a bigger picture, but they still had to filter it down in order to look at the schedule. I wanted to add in too that this report took my coworker and I 8 months to complete. So when it was done, we had something that had never been done before in our department. This data-driven decisions that could be made that affected the patrol schedule. So we took all those reports that we built in Power BI, which there was quite a few, and embedded them into a SharePoint site. So from that SharePoint site, that static report that we printed became a living report, where it could be refreshed every day or once a week or once a month, whatever they wanted to do. But they had the data that was in the report available at their fingertips at all times, and it was current. With this data, then, they were able to create work groups within the department. This was also a new concept they hadn't been done in other departments, where anyone in the department that wanted to participate, on the sworn side, regardless of rank, could come together and discuss proposals for the schedule. So they based it on our report. So they came up with several over a period of working sessions that they were able to then look how each schedule fit into the data. So in addition, the one challenge that they had these schedules they proposed, but how did it affect the workload? How do you see how this is going to work? You could see it on paper, compare what you've wrote out as a schedule versus the report, but you don't see how they work together. One of the things that I was able to do, which was probably one of my funnest things that I got to do in this project, was create a schedule simulator. The simulator took AVL data and the time on calls for every officer and determined how many officers were needed any given month. With the AVL data, it went back 5 months, any of those time frames that they could see whether they were understaffed or overstaffed based on the current schedule and the proposed schedules. So they took that simulator and they were able to manipulate it and see what it was in each month. So when they finally came up with a schedule that fit the data, we put that final schedule into the simulator and then created a component where they could adjust the staffing levels per team. So we ended up with 4 teams and a power shift, which was an 8-hour shift Monday through Friday in the afternoon, which corresponded with the data, which said that we had more calls in the early, late afternoons. So now they are able to take and change, say, if I wanted 16 people here and 15 people here, I could adjust it by 1 or 2 and see how it changed with the data that we had. With all these tools, and they implemented the schedule after I left, they started it in the September, and now they have all these tools at their fingertips that they can use at any time that they want to look at the patrol activity in the future.
I applaud the executives at the police department for getting input basically from the ground up. That's nice to hear that there was a lot of input. With the simulator, what were some of the calculations that you used?
So the AVL data showed how many officers were working at any given hour. So you had that as a count. We were able to calculate for every dispatch call how much time that each officer was spending. And we factored into that what is called a saturation index. So that saturation index for us was a threshold of 75%. So showing that in this calculation of how many officers is included that 25% of time for self-initiated activity, for training, for sick days, for whatever. So it was a buffer. So when that was calculated out and said, okay, at 3 o'clock in the morning, we needed 5 officers because the activity was so low, but we had 15 people staffed, then we were technically overstaffed. Now their minimum was 15. It wasn't like part of a contract or anything, but that was, we have to have all beats covered and 3 floats. No number would ever go below 15. But if you were in the middle of the afternoon and you had 30 people working because shifts were overlapping, but you only needed 15, that's where the simulator would show. And also it would show if, hey, you know, happened to be at 9 o'clock in the morning in April that we had some kind of major incident go on and now we were understaffed. The simulator was able to go back on that historical data with that buffer in place in order to show when we were understaffed or when we were overstaffed. So they used the simulator not only to evaluate the schedules that they had proposed, but also to adjust them if they needed it.
This kind of leads us into our next topic anyway that I want to talk to you about, and that's analysts using cost-effective software. You mentioned with Power BI that it's fairly low cost, but talk a little bit about why you think it's important for analysts to be searching out and finding these cost-effective softwares. And so we'll get into some different examples.
Okay. There are a lot of products available. You have, most agencies have a pretty good RMS and CAD system, but for the most part, you can't pull out all the data out of those systems. It's buried. It's their relational databases, which means a lot of that stuff is buried and you can't query it even within your RMS or CAD as well. And there are a lot of products that will absorb that data for you and create you nice little maps or charts or whatever, but they're expensive. And most departments work on a budget that doesn't allow a lot of money for products that haven't been tested and used that they can really justify spending thousands of dollars on a program. So I have always kind of prided myself on being an old-fashioned analyst because I came from Mansfield, Ohio, which was not a rich city by any means. And I was the first and only analyst, so they weren't going to go out and buy me a bunch of fancy toys. So I used all the products that came with my computer, which was, at that time, it was Access and Excel and Word and those Microsoft products. And I did 99% of the work that I had to do in those products. So I learned how to leverage those products, and it didn't cost the department any extra money. So when I came to Cary, we didn't have the fancy toys either. And we had a few things that had been purchased over the years, but not really used that well, or no one had been really trained on them. But I knew Excel and Access. And later on, like I said, I learned Power BI. But I learned how to leverage those programs specifically for crime analysis. So in Access, I built reports and to build out the database that did some amazing things. It provided a chronic offender list, or it was able to track trends, or it was able to really create reports from our data that included arrests and field contacts and any of those things that I needed to have on a regular hands-on basis. So to me, Access was the most powerful product that I had at the time. And I still, you know, I'm sure a lot of people would have a love-hate relationship with Access, but it was my favorite go-to because I could make it do all kinds of amazing things.
Yeah.
So I always then would promote, hey, let's use what we have, because not only is it the most cost-effective, it's the most versatile. You can do everything in Access from keeping track of your recipes to keeping track of your chronic offenders. The product itself is built for multiple platforms, you know, so it's something that we could definitely leverage. When Power BI came about, that was like our next big go-to. We have been able to do 99% of our work. We used ArcGIS just for mapping. Everything else came through Access and Power BI and Excel.
Now, did you spend much time trying to identify cost-effective software that you didn't have? Did you do many demos or work on stuff to say, oh, okay, we don't have this tool, but hey, I just demoed it. I'd like to bring it into the department. It's fairly low cost. Did you get into that situation?
Not so much. There was a couple of products that I think, if I remember correctly, was kind of inherited when I came in, but nobody was using it. And then they'd upgraded the product and reached out to us and said, hey, you know, we can do this, this, and this. I found that although, you know, they did some cool things and there's one of those products that would integrate a lot of different departments' data, which was nice to have, it didn't do all the things that I wanted to do. So I like that grounds up, hands-on, let me make it do what I need it to do. Most products that you buy, even though they're probably well-built and, you know, they're very useful for a lot of people, if you are an old-school analyst and you want to dig in, you want your own thing. You want what you can manipulate. When you buy a program and do, like you said, those bigger box-type programs, you can't go in and change it the way that you want it. And that's one of the things that I really liked about being able to have just those basic products is it depends on what's going on, whether you're trying to track a burglar trend or you're trying to do a personnel study. You have the tools right there at your disposal that you can create whatever you need to do.
Yeah, and I do encourage the audience as analysts to reach out beyond your police department to identify software that your city may already have purchased. I know when Chris Delaney was on the show, he talked about the fact that with Esri, it's, I think he said a couple of times a month when he goes to conferences, he finds somebody where the department couldn't afford it, but his city had already purchased the Esri license and therefore could leverage the city license, and that it wasn't a burden on the police department at all. So yes, consider that, getting to know what programs, and you should be doing meet and greets with other city department officials anyway, because that's, you never know what kind of data they're going to have that you could find useful.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So I do want to spend a little bit of time on your chronic offender recognition program, because you built that in Access. From what we were talking about in the prep call, this came to be pretty popular. So what were all the bells and whistles that this chronic offender recognition program did?
So, yes, it was called CORE, which, like you just said, is the Chronic Offender Recognition and Enforcement. So CORE would be able to manipulate or to calculate out a person's risk of reoffending. So that meant pulling in all of our RMS data for every call and every person that was involved, whether they were a offender, a witness, a victim, and every component of that got a score. So it was what kind of crime it was, had a score, their involvement had a score, if there was drugs involved and what type of drugs got a score, how long it had been since they had offended got a score. So all those components came together in an Access. I pulled everything into Access, and into an Access query, I was able to do those calculations. And so when we had, for instance, maybe a burglary series or a burglary trend going on, you could make burglary your highest crime type score. So it would calculate out and bring out a list of people based on their score that were your highest offenders, most likely to reoffend. The program itself seemed like very complicated, but the concept was that you're giving people basically a harm score, or a score that maybe would bring them to the top of the list, so that you can start deep diving into this person. Are they still in the area? Are they incarcerated? Do we still need to look at them? And then that information, as that was fielded by our criminal intelligence unit, would then be pushed out to patrol to keep an eye on these people. And it was also used for the detectives to start identifying suspects.
Where did you get the weights for each calculation? Because certainly all the various of activity that an offender could have, how did you come up with all the different values to calibrate the final score?
Well, I worked with our criminal intelligence unit primarily on trying to determine the order in which things should go. So, and some of the science and what they knew behind it. It's like where maybe a heroin offender may be more likely to offend because they need a fix. So that maybe get a higher score. Or even victims were taken into consideration, because it's like you're always the victim. Is there going to be a retaliation for whatever happened to you? And as far as the crime types, that was another thing that was almost manipulative. It was based on what was happening at the time and what these intelligence officers were looking at. So if there was a certain trend or something, they could make that score for that offense higher. So if a person had a burglary, you know, there's people that never had a burglary history, so they would be at the bottom of the list. But if you had a burglary history anywhere, your score would be higher. So they could start saying, okay, well, he has a burglary history. It's been this many days since he's offended, you know, and this is the final score would put them at the top of the list.
Did you do any after the fact testing to see how accurate the scores were?
The only testing I think that really went on was with the criminal intelligence unit. When it corresponded with what they were seeing and the information that the intelligence that they were receiving, whether they kind of lined up. And sometimes they did. Sometimes it's like, well, you know, this guy may have had a high history of burglaries, but now he's deceased. So that's where you, it would take the human element to go through this information and field it. And a lot of times, yes, this is the people they were seeing all the time. This is the people that were actually already somebody that they had their eye on. But this was the tool that they used to take out a lot of that bias. Okay. So they could actually say he is on our list because he scored high for whatever we're looking at. So they could take the bias out of it because none of it was based on anything but aggregated data. It was nothing to do with race, sex, age, or anything because the score would not even be calculated that way. That is one way that when they put out intelligence information and put these people's names and their faces out, they could say, based on the core score, these people came to the top of the list.
And this became so popular that an outside vendor wanted to mimic it?
Yes. An outside vendor wanted to be absorb it into their new analytical product that they were actually partnering with Kerry to build. Although I guess imitation is of best flattery, but it was still, without, this is what, the software vendor was saying, this is what we built and this is what we are going to do. You know, I had such great support in my department though. And they, like every one of them knew that I built it, even when it was put out on a national bulletin for this software company. He's like, they didn't build it. You did. So I had the support internally, whether they were going to give me recognition or not.
Are you going to tell us who that vendor was?
No. Oh,
I understand. All right. Very good, Beverly. You've accomplished so much over the 15 years of being a law enforcement analyst, and you did all this without a college degree. And I don't mean that in an offensive manner. I mean that as in today's age, seems like almost every law enforcement analyst job announcement is going to require a college degree. So can you just talk a little bit as you look back at all you were able to accomplish and then have that, I don't want to call it burden, but I'm sure it was something that would come up time and time again that you didn't have that college degree, but yet you were able to accomplish so much.
Yeah, I can say that because I have such a desire to learn that I kind of semi-regret that I didn't take it into formal training. But one of the benefits, I'm not saying it's one way or the other. I think I admire people with college degrees. I think they're brilliant and I love them dearly. But the one thing that I was able to do is every training that I took was very purposeful. And it allowed me to come back and use that information right away, whether it was learning a software application or it was learning something about crime analysis. I shouldn't say this a bit this way, but if it fancied me, I wanted to learn it. So I was given that opportunity within each department that I worked in. You know, I know that when I was building out one program in Access, I don't know if it was part of CORE or it was another one I did, but I wanted to know about neural networks. Now, that's not something you just kind of like pick up a book and learn, get a dummy book and learn how to do. Mm-hmm. But I had that interest to say, okay, now I've got all these people, how are they connected? And I wanted to know that. You know, even though I can't say I'm any shape or form an expert in it, I had the opportunity to say, hey, I want to learn about this. So either it was on my own that I reached out and did some networking, chatted with some people and read some articles to understand it better. Anything that I wanted to learn more about, I just did. And I had that fantastic opportunity to do that. You know, in early in my career, I was a traffic secretary. That didn't require a college degree to be able to type and take care of things in a traffic office. But in that same position, that was in 1998. And in the early 90s, I learned how to do Access because I was given that opportunity to do that. Yes, I mean, the formal training's not there as far as a degree, but I would say with all the training that I've done, I should have at least 5 master's degrees because I have always approached things with saying, what if and why not? What if I learn how to do this and I can make it do that? or what if I can find more about this kind of crime trend and get information out? So I never stop learning, and I have not stopped learning, because it's one of the driving forces for continuing to love this profession, even though I'm not doing it right now, is to be able to be a good analyst, an excellent analyst. You need to be curious and you need to learn new things as often as possible.
Nice. You know, the saying is necessity is the mother of invention. And I also think necessity is the mother of learning. And if you need to know it, that gives you that added drive to learn it. And it seems like that's what you did throughout your career. As things came about onto your plate, you were able to focus in and find the best solution for that particular issue. Mm-hmm. Kind of running out of time here. So I do want to talk last segment there about your personal interests. Because you mentioned you are no longer a analyst, so you have retired, but you have taken on activities as a Jehovah's Witness.
Yes.
And so I want to just take an opportunity to talk about what you're doing, maybe talking about Jehovah's Witness as a religion, some of the misnomers that you hear, and just kind of give you an opportunity to talk about that.
So I left Cary Police Department at the end of August of this year. And the reason that I retired, because I wanted to spend more time volunteering in the public ministry as one of Jehovah's Witnesses. You know, many people are familiar with Jehovah's Witnesses because they've come to their door. But did you know that there's over 8 million Jehovah's Witnesses in the world in over 250 lands? You know, we come from hundreds of ethnic and language backgrounds, yet we're all united by our beliefs. And each one of us spends time helping people to learn about the Bible and God's kingdom, which is the reason why we come to your door. And right now, rather than going door to door, in order to keep our neighbors safe and to keep ourselves safe during this pandemic, we have been reaching out to our neighbors either through writing letters or phone calls or even texting. And we have our meetings twice a week on Zoom.
So were you always a Jehovah's Witness, or is this something that you discovered later?
No, I've always been one of Jehovah's Witnesses. My mom was a witness as well. So this has always been something that I've always dedicated my life to. Really, the core of beliefs of Jehovah's Witnesses is based about our relationship with Jehovah God and imitating Christ Jesus. So Jehovah's Witnesses are Christians. And as Christians, we imitate Christ Jesus and we talk to other people about a better future, how the Bible can help you today, and really what God's kingdom is going to do in the future.
And then what are just some of the misnomers that you've heard that you'd like to clear up?
Well, I think people have said, you know, you don't believe in Jesus, which is absolutely untrue, because we are Christians, and we know that Christ Jesus gave his life on our behalf for a ransom, and that he is also going to be the king of God's kingdom. So in imitation of him and following his lead and how he talked to people about God and the kingdom, that's what we imitate. So we are absolutely Christians. And maybe some of the other things is why do you come to my door so often? And, you know, I'm sure
that was the one that I was most curious on.
Yes. Why? Well, you know, I mean, and it is really, if you think about if your neighbor's house was on fire, would you go and tell them? Most people would say absolutely yes. So we feel that this is a life-saving work. This allows us to be able to share not only how the Bible can help you today and how the Bible principles can make you a better person and be able to cope with stress and, you know, have a better family life, but it also gives you a solid hope for the future, and how that when going door to door, even if someone's not interested, we respect that, absolutely respect that. And we know that people have their own religion. But if they are interested in learning more, then we make ourselves available voluntarily to study the Bible with people and help them to gain that relationship with God.
Well, our last segment to the show is Words to the World. And this is where I give the guest the last word, and you can promote any idea that you wish. Beverly, what are your words to the world?
Well, I think there's a few things. It's important to maintain your work-life balance and to take care of yourself physically, emotionally, and spiritually. I think sometimes that gets lost in day-to-day activity, and we don't put ourselves first and don't take care of ourselves first. So that's absolutely the top of the priority, really, you know, putting our spirituality and our relationship with God first in our life. And I think as far as I work words to the world, keep learning. The one thing that we've had on our bulletin board at work for a long time was the letters W-I-Y-N is what if, why not? To approach every project with that in mind. So what if we did this and why don't we do this? Or, you know, why can't we do this? That keeps you curious. That keeps you engaged. That keeps you on track. The other thing that we touted was the 30-minute rule. If it takes more than 30 minutes to do something, there's an easier way to do it. So that was kind of our guiding phrases that we kind of went back to often in order to kind of approach whatever challenge that came our way.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later. But I do appreciate you being on the show, Beverly. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
You too. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcast.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Alder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.